So tonight, in honor of Halloween, which is tomorrow, I thought I would bring out Zen's best-known ghost story. And this is from the, well, actually it's referenced in the Mumonkan, the Gateless Gate, Case 35. The case is only one sentence long. Goso asked the monk, "Seijo and her soul were separated. Which is the true one?" And he's referring to this ghost story. It's a sort of folk story, which is very long. So I'm going to read it. Otherwise, if I try to tell it, I'll mess it all up. So I'll just read it,
Sure.
and then we'll have a look at it. So the story is, during the Tang Dynasty, there lived a man called Chokan. He had two daughters. When the elder girl died, he devoted himself to the younger, Seijo. Seijo's best friend was Ochu, whom she played with every day. And she had grown up with him in a union blessed since childhood, and she considered herself betrothed to him. They were that close as they grew up. But her father turned his attention to the question of a suitable husband for her as she grew up, and eventually selected a good and strong young man who was not Ochu. And when Chokan announced that his choice of a suitor was to arrive in the village, Seijo became downcast and sad. Ochu, unable to bear the prospect of witnessing the betrayal of Seijo, this betrothal to someone else, left the village without saying farewell. He took his boat and rowed into the night. And as he rowed, he noticed the outline of a figure running along the bank. He put into the shore to see who it was, and there was Seijo, tear-stained and adamant. Together, they traveled to a distant land where they lived as man and wife. 5 years went by. Seijo gave birth to two girls. They had a good life together. But though she loved Ochu and the children, she was weighed down by the dishonor she'd done to her father. There was a longing in her heart. So all this she told to Ochu, and he admitted that he too longed for his homeland. "Let us go back and beg for forgiveness," he said. And so they returned. At the port, Ochu left Seijo and the girls while he walked to the village. He went directly to Chokan's house and confessed the whole story and bowed his head at the ungrateful behavior. Chokan received him kindly. "Which girl do you mean?" he asked. "Who was it that you married and took away?" "Why, your daughter Seijo," Ochu replied. "Well, that's not possible," Chokan said. "Seijo is here in the house with me. Since you left the village without bidding her farewell, she has lain here. She lies here now." Mystified, Chokan refused Ochu's invitation to go with him to the port, and instead he sent a servant to check the boat. When the servant returned, reporting that it was indeed Seijo who waited there, Chokan took Ochu into the house. "She has not spoken since you left," he said. "It is as if she has been absent in mind or drugged. Now I see that her soul left to follow you." So saying, he showed Ochu into Seijo's room. Hearing the story, Seijo rose from her bed, still without speaking, and walked out into the village, just as Seijo and her children stepped from the cart that had brought them from the port. The silent Seijo moved forward to greet her, and they embraced. And as they did, the two were united as one. Chokan spoke to Seijo, "Ever since Ochu left this village, you have not uttered a word, and you have always been absent in mind as if you were drugged. And now I see that your soul left your body and has been with Ochu." And to this Seijo replied, "I did not know that I was sick in bed at home. When I learned that Ochu had left this village in distress, I followed his boat that night, feeling as if it were in a dream. I myself am not sure which was the real me, the one with you, sick in bed, or the one with Ochu as his wife." Ooh.
Wow.
And so Gosō asked the monk, Seijō and her soul were separated. Which is the true one? What's going on in this story? And how do we sort out who's the true Seijō? There are so many ways that we separate ourselves into parts and set one part aside as unacceptable, as the one that we can't be, and then go forward to be some other part that we recognize as being okay. Sometimes this is a sort of an intellectual pursuit. I know people who think that their emotions are not an acceptable way to maneuver through their lives, that it must all be from the mind, from the thinking, analytical mind. They must be very logical and not fall prey to what feels like chaotic emotions. And so those emotions get swept to the side, and everything is done through the thinking mind. And so something's lost. Some very valuable part of them is lost. Sometimes it's that we parse out certain feelings, certain emotions that we find problematic and say, can't deal with that, not going to go there, sweep that aside. And this isn't necessarily a conscious effort. It's sort of the way humans are wired, that we come to do this. In the case of a Zen student, we might feel that there's a certain way that a Zen student comports him or herself, and that to be rattled by things, to be uncertain, or to have doubts even about the practice is not acceptable. And so we put that aside and we put forth a persona of the calm, centered one. This sort of thing. And there's a psychological way of separating ourselves out too, that I'm sure we're all very familiar with. For instance, the judge who sits inside and says, oh, I told you shouldn't have done that. Now look what you've gone and done, and what a failure. Again and again, you do the same stupid thing. When are you ever going to learn? And we speak to ourselves in these ways. I mean, we've separated out the one who knows better, who wherever that one was when we were actually doing the thing that shouldn't have been done or failing at whatever, it's, has come forth now. And then, whoever that one is speaking to, who never seems to be actually there at the moment that it's, he or she is being spoken to. So it's this curious way of splitting ourselves apart. One time I was at the beach on the Cape, and there was a family next to me that came and spread out their blankets, and they had a bunch of little children ranging in ages, and all the older kids grabbed up their buckets and toys and what have you and headed off into the water, but the littlest one stayed behind. And she was this little girl with pigtails, and she had a pink and black polka dot bathing suit on with a little ruffle around the bottom, real cutie, just a little thing. And so she, I was trying to figure out what it was that she was doing. She would stand in this sort of empty sandy spot, with nobody else around, and she would strike these poses, like with her hands on her hips, and one finger wagging like this, and she would be sort of talking, but there was nobody there. And I realized that she had created this invisible friend, and the invisible one was definitely troublesome and just didn't get it, and so she would have to straighten this other one out. And sometimes she would take pity and like take the invisible friend by the hand and explain something patiently to him or her, and And so it was this whole psychology of splitting off being played out before me in this very obvious way. It was still outward, but of course eventually it becomes inward. We internalize it. And so this is one way that we survive in our lives, of course. It's a strategy. But if you don't recognize it as such, if it's just played out unconsciously and without any choice in the matter, then there is this feeling of separateness, such as Seijo had, and this longing to go back and to make it right, not even knowing what we long for. So one of the things that we do when we sit on the cushion is to allow these separated out parts to come forward. We're not using any strategies when we sit. We're just open to whatever arises. And so these long held down parts of ourselves have an opportunity to come forward. And we have a chance to see them and to meet them and to embrace them and become one with them. So we've been doing a series of talks on the liturgy, and this talk also ties into one piece of the liturgy, in my mind anyway, and that's the Gata of Atonement. There is a certain overtone of atonement in the story of Seijo and her desire to make right what went on with her father, the dishonor that she felt that she had caused the family. And I hear this, of course, this is what we are dealing with when we chant the Gata of Atonement. And I had often wondered, you know, what good really did it do for us to do this chant? You know, well and good to say, now I atone for it, but what does that mean? You know, how, in what way is this chant actually atoning? And of course, if there's some way to make an overt atonement for something that has gone wrong, to make an apology to someone, to return something that was taken improperly or whatever, then of course that should be done. But often, so many times, there's nothing that we can do. The wrongs are long gone, or they're impossible to set right, or and so this chanting of our atonement is a way that at least we can turn toward what it is that happened, not hold it away, not keep it separate, embrace it and say, and own it, and recognize that we were the ones responsible for it. And my teacher, Josh, is fond of saying, of pointing out that the word atonement can also be broken down into the two words at-one-ment. And I never really got what the point of that was until I thought about it in terms of this story of Seijo being separated from herself and how her way of atoning, of returning and meeting the part of herself that had been separated out was a process of at-one-ment. It was this unification. And I think that's true for anything that we've tried to push aside, that when we finally turn toward it, we are more whole. It is a part of us reclaimed. As with all the koans in the Mumon Kan, Mumon offers a commentary and a poem, a verse, to go with his, in this case, one-line koan. So I'd like to read the commentary and the verse. Mumon's commentary. If you are enlightened in the truth of this koan, you will then know that coming out of one husk and getting into another is like a traveler's putting up in hotels. In case you aren't enlightened, don't rush around blindly. When suddenly earth, water, fire, and air are decomposed, you will be like a crab falling into boiling water, struggling with its 7 arms and 8 legs. Don't say then that I have not warned you. And his poem, ever the same, the moon among the clouds, different from each other, the mountain and the valley. How wonderful, how blessed. Is this 1 or 2? So I hear in his comment about the coming out of one husk and getting into another, like a traveler putting up in hotels, this way that we have of one moment being this person, one moment being another person, presenting ourselves as parents to our children, as co-workers in the workplace, as Zen students when we come to the Sangha. And we have different ways of being, you know, maybe only subtly different, and sometimes very different in those conditions, like a traveler going from one hotel to another, checking into the parent hotel now, or checking into the teacher hotel. So his question holds up here as well. Which one is the true one? Is it the parent, the teacher, the co-worker? Is it the traveler who checks into these hotels? Do we even have to pick one? And so his poem, ever the same, the moon among the clouds, different from each other, the mountain and the valley, sometimes presenting us one, united, sometimes presenting as two, divided. Is this 1 or 2? And there.